Thank you for attending. Very happy to be with you tonight. My name is Mourad Montazami. I'm a curator and an art historian, working around Middle Eastern and North African modernities, let's say. And I'm working both at the Tate Modern here in London and also working independently for different projects like the exhibition here at the Mosaic Rooms, Behçet Sadr, Dust in Waters. So this Iranian woman abstract painter who was active from the 50s up until the 2000s when she passed away. So obviously I'm not going to detail too much of the exhibition. I'm going to present and introduce our guest tonight, but just to remind that the conversation that I will have here with Mr. Turaj Atabaki, who I'm going to present right now, takes place in a framework, let's say, which is the exhibition that maybe some of you saw, had the chance to saw at the opening or before, and maybe some of you didn't see, I'm not sure of, so really depending on your experience with this place. But for just to put it in one sentence, for example, in this room that we are here, you can get to see the very compelling black paintings, which for themselves, as one part, because they could play many parts, but one of the parts they could play is that visual metaphor of that black liquid going into forms of vortex or almost like kaleidoscopic shapes and organic forms that she played with, creating textures, patterns over these experiments that actually went through a quite significant and explicit visual metaphor of the oil industry and the oil liquid itself, far beyond oil on canvas, but oil in Iranian socio-political history. And so that's the correspondence or the general metaphor that we will be developing tonight, and maybe we can get other chances to make these connections with the artist's work. Since on the other wall over there, you have the photograph of an oil rig in southern Iran, likely in Bandar Abbas, that she went to photograph for herself. And she's the only visual artist from the 60s and 70s that I know who went to document the shape and the experience of these oil rigs and infrastructure in order to bring it as a visual metaphor in her own painting work. So my guest tonight, which I'm very, very, very happy to welcome, is Mr. Turaj Atabaki. I will present him quite briefly, probably too briefly, but I will also reference some of his work. So Professor Turaj Atabaki is a senior researcher at the International Institute of Social History. He is Professor Emeritus Holder of the Chair of the Social History of the Middle East and Central Asia at Leiden University, Netherlands. And among his major publications, I can remind you of Men of Order, Authoritarian Modernization under Atatürk and Reza Shah. So very interesting comparative study of Turkish and Iranian context. But also Iran and the First World War, and this is also a potential subject for us as we're going to question how oil can play not only as a visual metaphor, but maybe also as a pattern for a sort of underground political history or social history from the bottom, as Mr. Atabaki puts it in his research, and we're going to discuss these ideas. So eventually the role of Iranian oil in the First World War, that's maybe not very well known. And you also researched about Azerbaijan and the general Central Asian region That's also very interesting for us as a debate over our preconceived geographies and labels for example, the Middle East, which is a quite artificial construct where I guess Iran was included quite recently for that lexic of the Middle East. And Mr. Atabaki's work, of course, is also a resource for us to reconnect Iran to the Central Asian context and social history, that because there is a very rich and loaded social history of oil movements, oil workers, and oil political ruptures in the Central Asian context, to which Iran is probably the epitome, but at the same time only one place. So again, thank you for being here. We're going to take the time to ask you some questions for myself, and then let some room for the floor at the end of this conversation. So if we go back to this film that we just saw, the Ebrahim Golestan's Fire, there are probably too many ties or too many streams of ideas to get from there, but maybe I'll contextualize in two words. So Ebrahim Golestan is a renowned, and maybe more than renowned, some people consider him a living legend, novelist and filmmaker, and also art critic, and also a theorist. Anyway, by the beginning of the 60s, because the film is published or released in 1961, we're talking about a time when Ebrahim Golestan has already been equipped by the Anglo-Iranian oil company, who was giving equipment and structure to Iranian filmmaker in order to document the sort of current growth and system of oil. But in 61, he's already done a few more conventional films to which A Fire will follow in a more experimental, maybe we could say, or in a more abstract, almost cinematic experience. I guess the film is more about a certain noise, a certain contact with the reality of an oil field burning and going to decay, and not as the immediacy of a catastrophe, but really the duration of that catastrophe, right? During 17 days. And that sort of phenomenological or very physical contact that we get through the noise, through the colors, through the mix and the editing that's actually done by Furuh Farrukhzad, who is a renowned woman poet who died very young in the mid-60s and was a very close friend to Behzad Sadr, was the editor of that film. I think the editing plays a big part, because basically all this clashing and combination of colors, textures, clashing elements, and sort of chaos, basically, phenomenological chaos somehow, is meant to give you an experience of what's happening, but at the same time, I think, brings you in a totally different place than where we are. That could be an experimental film, that could be almost a painterly representation of Turner or something like this. But before we go to this sort of overinterpretation of that film, I would be very, very happy if you could maybe begin by telling us your own take on that moment of the oil industry in Iran and the sort of new wave cinema, a new trend of cinéma d'auteur that's using the oil infrastructure events, that happens to become a cinéma d'auteur or a real documentary work more than a simply commissioned or industrial film. I would be curious to know how you could respond to this very particular moment of social history, artistic history, mainly through cinema and oil, right?
Okay, thank you very much for your nice word. Before I'm commenting on my reading, my take of this film, let me tell you about to react to your question is that it was right after the Second World War with a radical labor movement in Iran. I'm talking about 1945, 1946, and then we have a mass strike in Abadan and in Abajari, Master Suleiman. And that was 1946, that large number of Iranian workers were killed during this demonstration. It was the bloodiest strike in Middle East at that time.
You say oil workers?
Oil workers. And that was a demonstration, that was a uprising in Abadan, and was a fight between different factions, and there was the government killed many government and the mobs supported by the government killed many oil workers, and almost near 50 workers were killed. That was the bloodiest episode in Iranian oil industry. In oil industry and in the Middle East at that time. And that was a turning point that, remember, that that time we had in Britain labor coming to power. You know, the Tories are out and labor coming here. So there was a shift in Anglo-British oil company policy towards oil workers. And they decided to go much for propaganda. So they set up this film, quote-unquote, industry for oil, to go and to show the very, very positive side of how oil contributed in Iranian day-to-day welfare state.
You could almost say how it became a soft power.
Yes, and that in that time, Ebrahim Golestan, that was 1948, that took this opportunity. He was working for the propaganda department of Anglo-British Oil Company in Abadan and publishing a newspaper called News of the Day, Akhbar-e-Rooz, and then he joined this crew of the film producer, filmmaker, and learn how to film. And that was the beginning. Later on, he left. He was coming from the leftist to the post to the party background, communist. And that was his background. And later on, he left Anglo-British Oil Company and tried to be an independent film producer, film director.
I think
that was the background of Ebrahim Golestan at that time. But something very interesting, if I may say something about this film, is that this is a film is 1950. This is the episode here is 1958.
Right.
Yes. This is 5 years after the coup d'état of 1953, and that was a turning point in Iranian history. Because we had 1951 oil nationalization, and 2 years later we had coup d'etat sponsored by the CIA and British Intelligence Service and toppled the Dr. Mossadegh government. And that is 53. And then from the 53, 2 years later, we had this denationalization of Iranian oil. And then we have this, the Iranian, we had there was an international aid companies came together, they set up a consortium of oil companies, and then they took it over. So the film, this episode happens 5 years after the coup d'etat, 3 years after this consortium was set. And I remember that was at the period that everybody in Iran, or politically minded Iranian intellectuals, I presume Ibrahim Golestan, I don't know for sure, they were thinking, I mean, what's it for the God's sake, we nationalize the oil, and now is a process of denationalization of oil. And when I see this burning, that reminds me a poem by Mustafa Sarkhosh. Mustafa Sarkhosh was a very, very, you know, JPMLD nationalist figure, intellectual, and he wrote a poem I recite for you. He says, "Last night with my own eyes and within my own house, I saw some water that was burning like a fire. I asked, 'What are you? And where have you come from?' 'You are but water, yet so able to make such fire. With few more flowers, it responded, a secret that sealed off my illusion. I am oil. How can I not burn out of my pride? Then one of my own has sold out me to a stranger.'" Let me to cite it in Persian, because when you translate it, it sounds a bit silly. "دوشینه به چشم خیش در خانه خیش آبی دیدم به سان آتش می سوخت. گفتم چه کی و از کجا آمده ای؟ ای آب چه می توانی آتش افروخت؟ با چند زبانه آتش گفت رازی که مرا زبان پندار بدوخت. من نفتم و چون نسوزم از غیرت خیش جایی که مرا خودی به بیگانه فروخت." This for me, this fire is a pride of oil. It's burning, part of pride. This reminds me of Mustafa Sarkhosh. That's it. Go.
From what year is the poem?
The poem is from late 50s. I don't know exactly, but I presume 1956.
Okay. 50, so it's the right time.
57?
It's yes, the right time.
Exactly.
So, I mean, what's interesting is how the particular time you described when the oil industry, that we're going to call industry for very shortly, because then we're going to shift to a very important question in Mr. Atabaki's work, which is a meaningless oil industry in benefit of what you could call an oil complex, more than an industry, strictly speaking, and what consequences of that. But before that, I was interested by listening to you that in a particular period of time, there is someone like Ibrahim Golestan who will be able to basically set up the first independent cinema studio, mm-hmm, in this new wave cinema happening in Iran in the 60s, and much inspired by ideas of the neorealism, the Italian cinema with neorealism. So this idea of penetrating the filter of, or transversing the filter to reality and be able to touch the reality through cinema is going to be imported somehow by figures like Ibrahim Golestan, like Kamran Shirdel, and they're all actually at one point or another involved with the oil cinema and the oil infrastructure that we discover now is not only an industrial infrastructure, but is also a cultural and even an artistic infrastructure, as you embodied yourself by reading the poem. So in that film again, and then maybe we can shift to another subject, but I'd like to have your reaction about this particular point, that to me it seems the burning or the explosion is as if the integrity of the infrastructure is exploded, right? So the process that normally happens within the pipeline and within the tubes and within the mechanical suddenly burst out, and it makes itself visible, obviously in a catastrophic way, but it's also a sort of uncontrolled image of what's going on in the pipelines when it works properly and when it's burned properly in order to become oil. And by listening to the poem, I was thinking so many references to fire, water, khak. So khak is dirt in Farsi. Atash is fire. Ab is water. And those elements keep returning in classic poetry. So is it Ebrahim Golestan who has a sort of maverick idea that this cosmogony or elements that you find in Persian poetry suddenly reappears in the oil context? Or you think it's just the sort of Iranian-ness of poetry that makes that anachronism possible?
Or both.
Or both, of course.
Or both. I'm more for both. I think, I mean, you can't, I mean, ignore Ebrahimic Golestan's attachment to Iranian mythology. Khak, Atash, Ab, water, fire. That's not that. But something I think for me as a social historian, as a labor historian, for me when I see this, it's how Ebrahim Golestan goes beyond a very, very episode that often happens in every industry. You know, oil is not exception. Every day you hear many, many examples all over the world, these things. But he goes beyond that, and he tries to see the impact of these episode, this phenomena burning to beyond that. When you see, for example, you have to, the villagers have to leave. You see, they are having a very peaceful life, and all by sudden, they have to leave. And that shows that is, this is not really, we are not talking about a commodity. It is a more than a commodity. Oil is a complex. And we should see oil as a complex. That I want to change the subject.
Of course,
if you don't mind, I mean, come to this point.
We need to hear you about this because it's a strong point.
Oil is not a commodity. You know, we're talking about oil as a commodity. Is oil, if oil is a commodity, oil is a socially produced commodity. But I don't think oil is a commodity. Oil is more than commodity. Oil is not industry. Because here we are not talking about the technology and fire. It goes, you have got the manpower, the human being are involved. Black-faced. They're drinking tea and they're working. So there are human beings are there. This is important. There are nature. Mother Nature is there. People are harvesting. They are there. So it's more than it's something, you know, abstract commodity. It's more than that. And it's not industry. It's not a technology. Let me just say even beyond that. It's not even financial assets. No, it's not that. That the bankers and capitalists, they can discuss about that. It's more than that. Oil is a complex. Oil has got is a complex that has got impact in every day of life.
And that's interesting because the film is like, it touches us, I guess, because of the noise, because of the shock.
Yes.
It's a bit like something touches us. Or
it comprises spaces, different spaces, you see that. And I can just say that, I mean, and shapes, you know, there is a culture there. Did you see that? I mean, the solidarity between the workers and then they come together and then depart. They bring people together and they depart apart. You know, it's something mm-hmm. is more than that. You see that. That shows that we are dealing not with a simple commodity.
Sure. For example, with that map that I'm showing here and I showed to you previously, we're looking at the end of 19th century cartographic interpretation of the Middle East and of Persia within that landscape. It's a very funny and peculiar map because from that time it doesn't look very realistic or objective in a way, and like from a conventional perspective the Mediterranean and the Caspian are turned upside down, and it's just like they tried to fit a certain number of zones and lines within non-coherent space. But by looking to the oil mappings dots, we can see that the interconnectedness is on oil fields, so the pink dots, refineries are the yellow dots, oil pipelines are the white lines, and then railways are included within this complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is only an esquisse of the complex, because the complex you're talking about goes obviously beyond mm-hmm. that. But can we just talk about the inclusion of railways and how the train economy happens to be part of the complex, which again shows that oil will become something that overwhelms the rest? Like the train economy is part of the oil complex in a way. So it's the oil complex that includes everything else, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, that the issue of transport in this part of the world is a very, very crucial issue. And was very, very underdeveloped up to even the Second World War. And when you look at the development in the oil complex, the priority is given to this pipeline and the route joining this pipeline together. And that was it. And regardless of the people living there, that was no matter. People were not really mattering for the oil companies, for the Anglo industry, Anglo-British oil industry, or for the other oil companies working in the region. People were not matter. What was really matter, that was especially before the First World War.
As long as it's on the map, it's fine to invade.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It was a turning point after this First World War. I'm talking about, because let me to tell you that how oil became important. Oil became important on the eve of the First World War, because there was a change from coal to oil. Germans were the pioneer in changing from moving from coal to oil, and later British, the American, the other countries, and then the British government invested 51% of the share of the Anglo-Iranian oil company and got the benefit of this shareholding. And then gradually, I mean, they had this, you know, development in oil complex. And then when we come to the First World War and after the First War, gradually you see there is a shift. Mm-hmm. So this map, if I look at this map, I can easily say this is really is dealing with, this is map is reflecting our culture, petroculture of the before the First World War. Because after the First World War, something changed. Gradually people became matter. After the First World War, in Iran and in the region. So you see that these transport, for example, became very important, not joining the oil fields and refinery, but also the internal market became very, very important, the domestic market. So they tried, I mean, to have a more rail joining the cities and different regions within the countries, within the borders of the country.
So speaking about borders, I wanted to add those images to the sort of end of 19th century map is more advanced and technological satellite views of the Zagros Mountains, So the Zagros Mountains are one of the most famous and somehow fetishized landscape of oil in Iranian modernity. And it's interesting maybe to have your reaction to this confrontation of an older representation that maybe, you know, seeks for objectivity, or maybe even doesn't seek for objectivity, because it really looks like an awkward cartography, even for the end of the 19th century. And then high-tech, satellite, borderless, because you were touching about the issue of border, the satellite view takes us out of those borders, right? And more to fantasize, I guess, over those mountains. There are so many movies in which the texture and the layers created by the rocks and the oil seeping through the rocks have been aestheticized, even by Ebrahim Golestan, by Kamran Shirdel. We can have a look to another film clip afterwards that shows this. Did you ever encounter in your research with that specific subject of the sort of more phantasmatic dimension of the oil landscape or universe, or maybe to some extent even to science fiction, I guess, as in some of the artist work exist?
Not gradually after, let's say, after the First World War, you see that this culture is coming. What we call it, petroculture, is getting more dimension. Okay. After the First World War, you know, and then and the petroculture is becoming trans-regional and more global and goes beyond the national frontiers. You know, for those who are involved in the international oil companies, border didn't matter. National border didn't matter. What was for them very interesting was that, I mean, where we can find oil, and where is oil, and that was a criteria. That was a criteria guiding them to see the. This is that how they see the world. Mm. You know, they see Iran. They say for Iran, they were not. I mean, the border between Iran or Iraq, or Iran or the Soviet Union, or Iran and the Indian subcontinent was not clear. There was not very, 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 you know, driving sharply. For them, that was beyond that. For them, they saw everything from this angle of where is oil. Mm-hmm. And this is something that you see that. If I want to add something here, to maybe, I'm not sure that this is the best way to add it. If I want to say something about this foundation or creation or refashioning, maybe the best word is refashioning this oil culture, petroculture. Mm-hmm. Is this refashioning of the petroculture has got two dimensions. One is that industrial modernization, and then you have this the oil capitalism. Oil capitalism and industrial modernization comes hand in hand. You know, we've got, if you look at the 19th century of the financial capital, you move from the financial capital to oil capitalism. And these two elements are refashioning this petroculture for the oil companies. And for them, these are two main criteria to see environment, to see transport, to see needs of development beyond the national frontiers.
But would you say that because it emerged during colonial times, it originally belongs to the territorial drawing made by colonial powers that make oil borderless by definition, or would you say that it had some national borders that were overcame later on?
No. I don't think that. I mean, we should bound everything to the ancient or to pre-First World War colonialism. I think by the end of the First World War, the perception of colonialism was changed. And there were new approach to if I use them in this word, it's a bit provocative, I say all sans frontier, without borders. All sans frontier. And this all sans frontier is that when you, as an oil company, you don't really see national borders matter. You don't see that, for example, different culture matters. You think, I mean, these are bunch of agents. They're working for this company. Just one good example, because when you talk about Iranian oil industry or complex, when you say about oil complex Iranian, because it's a very, very bounded national within the Iranian frontiers. But if I want to talk about, just give you one example, about the Saudi Arabia. You have the oil from Saudi Arabia. You send it to Lebanon, and you refine it there, and you build a pipeline taking the Saudi's oil to Lebanon. And if you look at the angle of the oil company who are engaged with this, I mean, these are same region. I mean, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, who cares? For them, this is the region that their interest lays there, and there are people here, regardless of the language they speak, the accent they speak, and things like that, their culture. They're just the agent of this company.
So this is pretty new colonial, right?
Definitely, is new, not the old one.
Yeah,
sure.
So maybe coming, I mean, so petrocultures certainly take different shapes, and petrocultures can go beyond even the lines of industry and art, or, some, even I would say official art and unofficial art, or again embodied by Ebrahim Golestan, something that you could call the avant-garde. Actually coming from the margins of that petroculture post-industrial complex, let's say. Another example may be interesting for us here would be this double page from a travel guidebook published in 1957 by Chris Marker, the famous avant-garde filmmaker, who before he produced films, actually he worked as a graphic designer for a French publisher, very famous, called Le Seuil, and came up with this idea of a travel guide collection book called Petite Planète, Small Planet, and each country, each volume per country, and the volume on Iran, which is a small 100-page book, big like this, finishes the last double page of that travel guidebook is that juxtaposition of Persepolis ruins on the top and the oil refineries of Abadan below. And without, again, going too much into interpretation, I found this image beautiful. Of course, because it's Chris Marker's idea before he became the famous Chris Marker. He was just an anonymous graphic designer. And even at that time, when he was not famous as a filmmaker, he didn't give his real name as a graphic designer. He was already using a pseudonym, Paul Le Chat. And in very striking image. I would like, I mean, my interpretation of that image in two words, is that the growth and the prestige of oil landscape and refineries landscape has something of the prestige and cultural growth that the idea of Persia and Persepolis, or the general empire you know, the growth of the empire culturally, geographically, is reminded or reenacted through oil. Mm-hmm.
Sure, definitely. I mean, for those of you who are familiar with the Iranian history, I should say that, I mean, you know that we had two revolutions in the 20th century, a 1906 and 1979. I always add another third revolution and the discovery of oil. The discovery of oil was definitely another revolution in Iranian history. Maybe not political history, but social history.
1908.
When we had the discovery of oil in Manchester, Iran. And for the 100 years, oil crafted the culture in Iran and refashioned Iranian everyday life. You know, every culture, you know, when we talk about the petroculture, every element of culture has a material base, definitely. And oil had its own material base, culture. And then when you talk about oil, is that not oil change everyday life of the Iranian in the south, but the impact of oil in city planning, architecture, education, poetry, prosa. I can give you many examples. Many. That was the one I studied. That was the only one. I can give you a lot about a good number of examples about how oil really impacted the poetry in Iran in 20th century. We have got many oil poetry genre in Iranian literature, in prosa, novels, short story from Ahmad Mahmud to Nasim Khaksar, Adnan Qureifi, Hamdullah Qaisari. I can give you names, you know. These are all people in one way or another, they were really identified with oil.
Are most of these still published? Or would you say that they're forgotten literature?
No, they're not forgotten. Ahmad Mahmud is still there, but I mean, some of these work are not really. For example, for a while, Ahmad Mahmud's work was forbidden to be published. Now you can find it. Nasim Khaksar, the same. And you see, and then I can go even beyond that. I say this petroculture in Iran, and I'm not saying only in Iran, in every country. You know, I just worked for the last, I mean, 10 years for the oil, and then I can say the same thing with Nigeria or Venezuela or other countries. The same is not Iranian case is not very special.
So would you say that even this type of phenomenon, which is exactly the epitome of what Professor Atabaki was explaining now, it's photographs of the educational, cinema, artistic workshops, and social clubs all happening in the city of Abadan?
Abadan and beyond Abadan. Abadan is an icon of oil culture, sure, petroculture, but it goes beyond Abadan. You know, a village of few thousand family gradually expanded to a city of a quarter a million. And they had own culture of Abadani. Who is Abadani? People who migrated from Lorestan or the Arab community there or Behbahan, they became, identified themselves Abadani. And they became very different from the other Iranians because the first cinema was in Abadan. The first airport was in Abadan. And then they are proud of to have a Ray-Ban glasses, jeans, and Clark. You know, this is Abadani boys. And Abadani. And then you have got the Dukhtar Abadani. You know, who is Dukhtar Abadani? Dukhtar Abadani can dance. I mean, when the dancing was almost, I mean, non, unknown in other parts of Iran. We had the clubs.
She's at the social club.
Yeah. We've got the clubs, and for different, very, very still colonial stratification, of course. But we had a club for the laborers, club for the middle class, for up club manager. You know, we had different type of clubs, swimming club, you know, dancing clubs and everything, cinemas and things like that. So this is a culture. So it goes beyond the, you know, the buying, you know, extracting, refinery, buying and selling. It's bringing a civilization. If it's not too much, I can say all civilization here we have in these countries. Oil-producing countries, which is in somehow, you can call it, I mean, so blessing, you can say curse, but the society, to a large extent, was changed through this socially produced commodity, oil complex.
That's very interesting. I was about to show you, I mean, after we saw these images of Abadan surrounding, as you explained brilliantly, maybe we can go over a few other examples of the visual or artistic side of it, like the workers' posters. I have, unfortunately, only one example here of a May Day landmark poster celebration for oil workers, and is another kind of aesthetization or oil aesthetics in a way through graphic art. And that was very common, I believe. There were numerous posters, workshops, and sort of artistic groups working around posters. And those who work in the Iranian art history field know the importance of graphic art and especially poster making in Iranian visual culture throughout the 20th century, even foregrounding the what you call the fine arts or the avant-garde arts. Then I wanted to, because it would be a shame not to see it by close, so that's the photograph when Behjat Sadr, the artist of this exhibition, goes to the south of Iran, to Bandar Abbas, seemingly, to document and photograph that infrastructural shapes and that sort of, you know, preposterous landscape or anachronistic landscape. Anachronistic, why? Again, because of the combination of the sort of virgin nature and organic field, be it the sea or the forest or the seashore, and how this industrial complex will invade on that landscape or, you know, juxtapose to that seashore or to that forest or to basically wherever it has to dig. And one of her landscape paintings that we see here, I'm reminding you because it's hidden behind the aluminium painting over there, and that's a specific painting that she herself used to tell as an oil landscape, with the blue and red lines representing the Gulf. Actually, she speaks about the Gulf by analyzing her own painting. We have other examples of modern Iranian icons like Bahman Mohasses, who is another renowned Iranian artist from the 60s and 70s, who approached it at very different stages of his life. You have at the center an early and youth portrait of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, so the 1953 coup that Mr. Atabaki explained to us. And much later, representation of animals taken in oil slicks. So natural catastrophes out of the oil complex, with birds and fish taken or somehow sculpted, you could say ironically, by the oil. I mean, again, I remember you saying that in your work, and everybody could feel it before we pass on to the floor, how much art and the visual arts are the main material almost you're working with. You insisted that you're not into political studies, but you're into social history, and a social history from the bottom. So I now understand that oil is also a complex, as you commented for Golestan's film, where we can grasp this history from bottom, mainly because of the workforce, but eventually almost for geological reasons, because it comes from the bottom, right? And again, you're closer to an art historian, because you were telling me all the poems, the films, the narratives that come into play with your research make you much closer to an art historian than to a political thinker, right?
Let me to just, before I mean the final words, and I'd love to have your feedback, is, you know, part of this petroculture, I said, this industrial modernization comes, and the accumulation of the capital and oil capitalism. You know, something with, I'm talking about the Iranian case, has been overlooked is the agency of workers, Iranian workers, in practicing modernization. And this is really has been overlooked. You know, we are talking about the agency always has been limited to this development of the state, and the workers' position agencies has been forgotten. Just wanted to say that when you talk about this very nice poster, I've seen it here, you know, of the May Day 1979, that reminds me the first poster produced by the oil workers for the 1st of May, that was 1946. The first poster produced by the oil workers in 1946, when we had this strike in Iran. So the Iranian oil workers were pioneer in bringing modernity and right of workers in public space, in law, and adding something to the labor law and the rest. So that's what I wanted to highlight it in this time. And something here I just want to say that, I mean, when I see this Behjati Saj's work, you know, that this really, you know, adds to what I was telling you that there are a lot you can see when the we are talking about petroculture, how the oil refashion, change everyday life of the people living there, or people go and visiting there. You know, in somehow you can see, if you see it in poetry, if you see it in prosa, if you see it in literature, why not in painting? Why not in film? So I can see that. Although I'm not, I mean, this is beyond my expertise, I'm not an art historian, I don't know anything about painting, but as a social historian, I should say that, I mean, that is, I see that. I feel that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for your attention. Maybe you'd like to have some questions, and we saved half an hour, so I would say it's a luxury of time, right?
About
15
minutes.
15 minutes. Even more luxury of time. You have any, yeah, because we have to leave before 9, of course. Yes, please, any comments or questions?
Yeah, but mine doesn't really do art history. I'm
is really not what?
Why, after 8 years, almost 8 years on the discovery of oil, why they were working in such rudimental ways in Iran?
What, sorry?
Why, almost 80 years after the birth
100
of
years.
History, why were they working in such rudimental ways when they were oil.
In the film, you mean?
Yes.
Rudimentary ways of fixing the accident, you mean? It was
1961. It was very basic. I mean, you know, the oil industry.
Are you talking about the film?
Almost 80 years old. I can't believe that they were pumping oil the same way in Texas at that time.
Well, it would bring the costs down.
You know, that in 1961 it seems to her very rudimentary, as if it was beginning of 20th century, I think. It's true that it's rough, but they're fixing an accident. Remember that in the film they're not producing oil, they're preventing oil to be wasted.
Yes. Yes, this is a good question. This always means that seven years ago, I had a conference, organized a conference in Amsterdam, and we had scholars from all over the world. And then their perception of oil was different. You know, a Nigerian and somebody from Venezuela, from Mexico, from United States, different. And for the Iranian, you know, if I want to compare with U.S., but let's say, for example, we are talking about the Texas, you know, this region, is although oil is a pillar of industrialization and change in this state, but there are other elements adding to that. So oil is not really the only one. Oil is among the many other elements for a U.S. citizen or somebody from this province to a large extent. But for the Iranian, oil is the soul, the only thing they can identify themselves with. Like, for example, the Chilean with copper. Did I answer your question? I think this is a monoculture economy. And this is, they are very attached to that. In every corner, even in political discourse in today Iran, you know, it's almost unavoidable to touch about politics and not to say anything about, not to give any reference to oil.
Oil is very political.
Very, very political. But for the other country, there are other political elements, not only oil. For the Iranian, oil is the only one.
Another question or comment? Yeah, Simon.
I have a question and opinion.
Begin by the question.
Yeah.
And save the opinion to reply to his reaction.
Oil, discovery of the oil in Iran and in the whole Middle East, it was kind of surprise to some non-modern countries. Okay, at the time in 1908, compared to some place like Norway, which oil discovered at 1969, the country was already modernity was there.
Before oil, in Norway.
And the oil made added value to the country, to make the democracy, modernity, everything more rich. But in Middle East, I think it was a curse at somehow, because everything was imported. Everything was not feel like in Farsi called Basmei. All the modernity was on the surface. You know what I mean? Because the foundation was not there. You know, even if you take a look at art, like in 1950s, so many people went to Europe to study and bring right away like Cubism or abstraction. Or like in the art history of Iran, you don't have that kind of gradual movement from 19th century painting to Impressionist to Cubism. You know, it's not a gradual. That's why I think the whole modernity in Iran, we have a gap. I think the countries that they had democracy before discovery of the oil, they have more advantage than us in Middle East.
Wow.
That's it's a complex, I don't know.
But it make. I mean, as a question, it certainly makes sense because it's. Does it have to come before or after in terms of modernization? But is it that mechanical or is it? I don't know.
No, it is a long discussion because we have got two different approach, you and me, because I understand, you know, the core of your argument is that you think that modernity was a European phenomena. And it's a linear, and the people, they should pass through the same line and without interruption. My reading is that I consider modernity as a global phenomena and non-linear. And now we are not waiting, as Chakrabarti says, in a waiting room to say, oh, your turn is not, you should be modern. No, I don't see that. Indian modernity, Iranian modernity, we've got different type of modernity. Modernities. And in fact, I mean, that is my reading of modernity. And I think, I mean, that's something else I should say, that, I mean, those people who say it was a curse, I don't think that, I mean, those countries, those societies who didn't oil was not blessed either. So compared with the other countries, they didn't have oil. I mean, we have, for example, in Caucasus, in Central Asia, in North Africa, you know, neighboring countries, Turkey, you know, no oil, no democracy. So I think it's just very reductionism or essentialism. Essentialist is that when you reduce, we say that, I mean, oil was a curse. We benefited from the oil, people lived better with oil, but the way that we have got this uneven development, if you may say so, if I use this term, uneven development in these societies, nothing to do with oil. There are other reasons for this uneven development. I don't want to go to
that.
I'm
just going to get really, really picky here. So I think a lot of the question of oil and its commodity status. You say oil.
Are you a student of Mr. Atal?
No, I read his work. I'm not a student.
Okay, great. I'm just checking.
You have privilege.
When you say oil is not a commodity, it's not a complex, because A is somehow dispersed amongst a bunch of different ways of working, but also because it brings with it a set of social relations, which is where oil kind of gets value, right? That's kind of how I understand your argument. Isn't that how all commodities function? Wouldn't that then go on to say that oil is actually a commodity? It's a big question, and I think about it a lot. You maybe unpack that a bit.
I don't really think that I don't want to really limit myself to oil when I say complex. In fact, today I was talking with one of my colleagues sitting here in the back. He's doing his PhD on copper. And I was telling him, for me, copper is a complex. When you talk about the copper, how copper changed everyday life in Chile. You know, without copper, there was other Chile. And copper really made Chile different. Not only politics of Chile made different by copper, but the social setting of Chile was different.
They made touch screens from copper, right?
Sorry?
They made touch screens, like a smartphone touch screen from copper.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I think with some commodities, I can't go that far to say with every commodity, but with certain commodities, I think that you can talk about this complex. It's not only commodity, complex. And this is something that, you know, if you just reduce it to this commodity, you don't see the impact of it produced. The impact it had in everyday life that you don't see that anymore. Mm-hmm. So I go beyond that. I say that it was with other commodities or other material commodities you find in this culture.
We have two other questions at least, maybe four. But Mend, please.
Something you said earlier struck me. So you were saying that oil informed a particular kind of culture in Iran, and Moradi shows images of Iran when really it was a state of mimicry, right? I mean, the culture of the colonizer was mimicked in many ways. And then I was wondering, like, how was that particularly different to other countries where oil didn't play any significance, sort of Egypt or many other countries around the world where there wasn't so much a particular commodity that informed their culture after decolonization or anti-colonization?
Mm. This is a good question. You know, for example, if you compare Egypt and Iran, one country with oil, another country without oil. And so that if this is goes back to the same question that we discussed about that, I mean, blessing comes where? Here or there? And to what exchange, you know, this is bringing another subject, I mean, to our discussion, which is called renter state. That people, they think with, because in a renter state, when you have oil, like commodity, like oil, you have that, yet you have less accountability because you don't collect taxes from individuals and the government can leave someone laying on rent of oil, you know? And this is something that brings us to this discussion that, for example, which country is less accountable, Iran or Egypt? How is possible to link accountability and good governance to producing a commodity source like oil? I don't want to say that rent is not matter. Rent matter, definitely. But I think there is more than rent matter when you talk about accountability and good governance.
Okay. Maybe we can have two last questions, but quick and very efficient ones, of course. Yes, please.
Yeah. I was actually wondering if, Mr. Atabak, you could name a few books which actually look at basically the history of Iran from the perspective of oil. And especially the focus on culture, basically, and arts.
Sure. With all pleasure, I can. If you give me your email, I can give you a list of articles and books.
But it's mainly your books, anyway.
Yeah.
It's mainly his.
We are a group of researchers at the International Institute of Social History in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. We work on 100 years social history of labor in Iran in all industries.
Definitely check that. But I was wondering if there was like one specific book that you were kind of like more sort of like...
I think it's the next one that you're publishing in 2019.
Yes.
Which title is going to be...
Social History of Art.
In Iran?
Yes.
And it will be published in...
Yeah, there is a book, if you want, I mean, it's already published by Paul Grave. I have edited this together with my other colleagues. Paul Grave is published, I mean, a few months ago. Paul Grave is called... Paul Grave, publisher.
It's the publisher.
It's called Republican. It's published, I think, 4 months ago. If you go to Raja Terbaki and Paul Grave, comes the title of my work was called Working for Oil. This is a comparative studies of not Iran but other countries. This is the thing that I just jumped to my mind.
Dave,
but I don't want to promote myself. You don't need me to buy this book.
Because
for my book. I don't want to hate. I don't like this.
Dave.
I just
want
to ask a super historical question and bring it back to the film. And do we know who's the audience of this film? Where's it being shown? Is it being shown in Iran? Is it being shown in the UK? Is it being shown to? I mean, the reason I ask is, it's quite colonial film.
In many ways,
so I'm wondering who's it for?
Yeah, I would before. I think maybe Mr. Atabaki could have a memory of if it was screened in public cinemas or not. But what I could say is basically, yes, it's very colonial because it sounds like a very Western and very advertising almost voiceover, but the sort of phenomenological action of those images on us, I guess, brings something, to my view, not an ideal advertising for the oil company, right? Because it's 17 days of basically an industrial catastrophe that never ends. So you could also consider it's not the best publicity for that company anyway. But do you know or do you remember if it was screened?
No. I can't remember.
I think we should explore that, but it should have been screened.
I think it's been screened in Tehran Short Film Festival.
But we're speaking about the time of the film, right?
No, at the time, no.
Because I think the question was about beginning of 60s when the film was produced. But of course, now it's even on Vimeo for free. So it's obviously, it seeped like liquid. Now it's free to see.
But click the right link, please.
Okay, so last question. Sorry, man, I'm doing...
Go ahead.
I'm fussing around.
I was just wondering in your research if you saw another kind of energy, because nowadays oil is an energy of the past, right? Also, we see the trouble Iran is in right now as the U.S. is doing pressure, so that there's not export anymore. I'm just wondering if you see another energy, because Iran has huge resources, that has the hope for tomorrow's energy, because now oil is seen as something that actually doesn't bring much anything good anymore, it says.
Water, we don't have anymore.
No. I mean, to be very honest with you, I'm very hopeless. Not only I don't see anything about any energy for Iran at the very present time replacing oil. There is no planning. No. I don't see really things. And most things I said. Let me to finish. I didn't want to finish it with the sad words, but most of things I said about oil culture, petroculture, Abadani culture, most of these things were destroyed by the 8 years war.
The Iran-Iraq war.
Iran-Iran war. Not only that, and most of these culture destroyed not only by war, but also by practice of theocratic regime.
Enjoy your time.